Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jana Vallabha. Yashoda Nandana Brajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Brajajana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari Gopijana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yashoda Nandana Brajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jayam Vishnu Padaya Paramhamsa Parivragacharya Ashtatarasta Shri Srimad His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jayam Vishnu Padaya Paramhamsa Parivragacharya Ashtatarasta Shri Srimad His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai. Anda Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Srimad Bhaktam Grantaraj Ki Jai. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimati Chandramani Swami Bhaktivedanta Swamiji Namaha. Namaste Saraswati Devi Guravani Pracharani Nivishesha Shunya Bhavati Pracharani Shatavi. Vancha Karu Pataru Vyascha Kripa Sintu Vyasa Vyascha Patidanam Pavanevi Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam. Canto 10, chapter 8, verse 24. Yarhi Angana Darshaniya Kumara Lilav. Antarvrajetat Abalath Prakrita Puchaihi. Vatsair Itas Tata Ubav Anukshayamanu. Prakshantya Ujhita Graha Jakshur Asantyaha. Yarhi Angana Darshaniya Kumara Lilav. Antarvrajatat Abalakh Pragrhita Puchaihi. Vatsairitas tata ubav anukshyamanan nau. Prakshantya ujihita griha jakshur hasantyaha. One more time. Yarhi angana darshaniya kumara lilav. Antaravrajitada balak pragrahita puchaihi. Vatsairitas tata ubhavanukshyam manau. Prakshanta ujihita griha jakshur ashantayaha. Yarhi anjana darshaniya kumara lilav. Antarvraje tad abalakh prakrhita puchaihi. Vatsairitas tata ubhav anukshyamanau. Prakshanta ujihita griha jakshur hasyanta. Yahi angana darshaniya kumara lilav. Antar vrajetada balag pragrhita puchaihi. Atsaritas tata ubhavanukshyamanu. Akshanta ujita griha jakshur ashyanta. Yarhi anga darshaniya kumara lila. Antar vrajeta dabala pragrhida puchaihi. Atsharitas tata ubhavanukshyamanau. Prakshantya ujihita griha jaksurhasantyaha. Yarhi angana darshaniya kumara lila. Anvraje tadabalak pragrhita puchaihi. Atsairitas tata ubhavanukshyamanau. Rakshanta Ujita Griha Jakshur Vishanta. Word by word translation. Yarhi, when Angana Darshaniya, visible only to the ladies within the house, Kumara Lilao, the pastimes of Sri Krishna and Balaram exhibited as children. Antar Vraja, within the inside of Vraja, in the house of Nanda Maharaj. Tat, at that time, Abalaha, all the ladies, Pragrahita Puchaihi, the ends of their tails having been caught by Krishna and Balaram. Vatsaihi, by the calves. Itah Tataha, here and there. Ubau, both Krishna and Balaram. Anukrishyamanau, being dragged. Prakshyantyaha, seeing such things. Ujihita, given up. Grihaha, their household affairs. Jakshuhu, enjoyed very much. Hasyantah, while laughing. Translation. Within the house of Nanda Maharaj, the cowherd ladies would enjoy seeing the pastimes of the babies Rama and Krishna. The babies would catch the ends of their calves' tails, and the calves would drag them here and there. When the ladies saw these pastimes, they certainly stopped their household activities and laughed and enjoyed the incidents. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. While crawling in curiosity, Krishna and Balaram would sometimes catch the ends of the tails of calves, and the calves, feeling that someone had caught them, would begin to flee here and there, and the babies would hold on very tightly, being afraid of how the calves were moving. The calves, seeing that the babies were holding them tightly, would also become afraid. Then the ladies would come to rescue the babies and gladly laugh. This was their enjoyment. Om Agyana Tiram Dasya Gyananjaya Shagara Chakshumtam Gyana Tashmai Shri Guru Venamaha Shri Chaitanya Manavishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupam Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadandikam. Thank you for assembling here today. I apologize for my not very good pronunciation of the Sanskrit words. As I was reading it the other day, it was kind of hard to pronounce some words. But the English translation is a little bit easier to read. So thanks for bearing with me. So it's a very special verse, you know, and we can see that God, Krishna, always has a great time, and we can also have a good time. You can see how the his childhood pastimes, and then his parents, all the ladies and the animals of Vrindavan were enjoying. So this is our joy. We can read about these pastimes, chant them, share our experiences, meditate upon them, and internalize them. And in this way, we can see them within the core of our hearts, and we can develop a desire to, a stronger desire to participate in those pastimes in specific ways. This is our long-term goal by reading such pastimes and meditating on them. We will develop desire to be part of them eventually. And our future is very bright, the best future we can aspire for, just, you know, reading about Krishna and meditating and having him in our hearts the whole day. Most people in this world, they do not have the faintest idea about this spiritual science, and obviously they try to find their own ways of enjoyment. Srila Prabhupada uses the word, translates, and the enjoyment, spiritual happiness, enjoyment. So people don't have the faintest idea, and they just enjoy in their own ways. And Krishna gives them this freedom of choice. So we can do our best and try to reignite their interest in the spiritual science. And those who are not Krishna conscious or who may have some dormant, oh, we all have a dormant desire. Some dormant desire, some to engage in spiritual practice. So we'd like to reignite their interests in this. So in today's lecture, I'd like to focus on contrasting the spiritual happiness and with material happiness. Because we see that devotees try to go to one side and focus on serving Krishna and developing that spiritual happiness. And those who are not devotees, or officially not devotees, they tend to engage themselves in different ways, other ways of entertainment and enjoyment. So I'd like to contrast these two types of happiness. I'd like to give an example of something that happened years ago. I was working, this will illustrate how I myself need to work on reaching out to others in the right way. And maybe you can help me out. We can, maybe after telling you this about this incident, maybe you have some ideas about how to reach out to other people who are not devotees officially. So this incident happened years ago, and I was engaged in some projects, and for my own profession, for my own job, and I was really excited about it. And in the course of time, I contact another person to help me in this project, and they were a healer, energy worker, supposedly an elevated personality, and they would be able to help me to publish some works that I want to publish or whatever. And so we came in contact, and if I feel the situation is right, I oftentimes invite people to the temple. However, not everyone, just certain people. But since that person was an energy worker and a psychologist, you know, more spiritually open, we talked business, we talked about our projects, how we could work together. And then I invited them to the temple. So they came on their own, not with me. I came with my family, or, you know, more direct friends. But it was some holiday. Could have been maybe Krishna's birthday, maybe Govardhan puja that's coming up next Thursday. And so I don't know when they came, but they came during the course of our celebration. They came and I noticed them in the crowd. I did not have a chance to talk to them more. During our celebration, we did Abhishek, we did, you know, all the pujas, and I saw that the newcomer was observing and took some pictures, and then left. And then they left. I'm not sure if they stayed till the end of the celebration or not. But anyway, I was happy. I thought they had a good impression of our temple activities. And we got together, for I was happy to work with that person on the project, to collaborate. And so we got together again to work on this project. And at the very beginning of our appointment or session, they pointed out to me that, listen, you are a professional, and I respect you for what you're doing as far as your job and this project that you're working on, but these activities, please excuse me for relating this incident, but they were very polite, but they said these activities that you're doing at the temple and your friends are doing, these activities are for children, it's a child play, it's not for adults who are serious about life. So I was dumbfounded. I was like, oh, I didn't expect that. And so I thought they had a great reaction. And so I said, I don't know what to say. So I came up with some answer like, yes, I am very serious, maybe sometimes too serious about my my job and all these things. So I just take a break and you know, I'm a little bit more like a child over here. So it's good for me, so stress relief. So I said something like that. I don't know what to say. I didn't have a good answer. I just said something. Anyway, this session, the meeting between the two of us, was the last one, and somehow it didn't work out. So they were not able to help me with this project because I think they didn't want to be associated with me in case it comes out that I do these kind of practices and I'm a professional, I'm doing my job and trying to publish something, you know, and this and that, so they didn't want to be associated with me. But anyway, I completed the project myself and found someone else. But what this made me think, that the very educated individuals and supposedly elevated at the spiritual level, I failed at creating a lasting interest, and I didn't keep the lines of communication open. Somehow we lost contact, and you know, I don't know what happened to the person. I might still be able to contact them because I know someone who may know them. But anyway, so this situation was very interesting. I thought I invited them. Everything was good, and it would help us to be a better partners for our project. However, the reaction was adverse, and they were not able to even work with me because they thought that I was doing something strange that children are doing. So that made me think that, that when we reach out to others and try to invite them to the temple and talk to them, everyone needs a different approach, and within our practice of reaching out to others through prasadam and chanting, there's still enough room to individualize that approach to each person and come up with novel ways of reaching to others so they can relate to our movement more. So that's what came to my mind. And with the topic of today's talk, I would like to list the qualities of spiritual happiness and the qualities of material happiness, and maybe list some ways that I use to reach out to when I talk to others to make the explanation is more relatable to them because they maybe have react differently than we expect. We talk to them directly and very spiritual. They may not want to associate with us. So I think my underlining goal to maybe come up with some examples, which I already have written down, obviously, examples that that help those people who are outside of our circle of devotees relate to our practice. So this situation don't happen. Like, I don't know, maybe you don't have this experience, but I had a completely unexpected experience with that person, so I feel bad about it, but what can I do? I can't go back in time and fix it and maybe say something different, or maybe I shouldn't have invited them to the temple yet. Yeah, I don't know. But moving on with our talk, spiritual happiness has these qualities. It's never-ending, and it's enjoyed with the spiritual senses of our soul. And it's blissful, and life is the nature of the soul. The nature of the soul is to serve Krishna. And it's also enjoyed in full knowledge of Krishna as the recipient of happiness, the subject of all happiness. It is oriented towards satisfying Krishna and not ourselves. Therefore, automatically involves detachment from anything else. Material happiness has opposite qualities. It's temporary, enjoyed with the material physical senses, and it's relieving the symptoms of our disease. Our disease is envy of Krishna, or forgetfulness of Krishna, and we're trying to satisfy the nature of our soul through the material senses, being forgetful of Krishna and envious of him, whether we realize it or not. So we are trying to relieve the symptoms of our disease, and that's why we end up frustrated sooner or later. And the third quality of the material happiness is that it's enjoyed in ignorance of Krishna, with forgetfulness, which I already mentioned. So I'd like to elaborate on these points, especially the qualities of material happiness and how we can point it out to others who may be therefore more attracted to adopting our philosophy of life, if you present it the right way to them. Devotees, obviously, devotees here know all these facts about spiritual happiness, and so I guess the subject of this lecture is to just maybe, you know, brainstorm, get some ideas of how to present things in a different way to others, you know, in addition to, you know, the usual and the most potent chanting and then distributing books and prasadam. Sometimes we're in situations where we cannot directly do it for whatever reason. So material happiness is temporary, and we enjoy with the material senses. And I have encountered individuals in the course of my doing my work and, you know, preaching efforts, or, you know, talking to others, that for them to think that something is eternal is unnatural. They think in temporary terms. They think that it's okay to have temporary goals, and that's how life is. Everything has a beginning and an end, and there's no problem with it. That's how it is. Actually, they cannot relate to concepts such as eternality. They have a hard time thinking about these things, and therefore they don't worry about it. So moving from one goal to another, getting tired of one thing, one project, moving on to another one, that's how most people work. And some other group of people believe in searching out some permanence and things that last a lifetime. So to the first group of individuals who are okay with accepting the temporary nature of things. I sometimes use this example in the business world. In the business world, virtually all of the businesses focus on long-term gains. In any sort of material endeavor, you would like to have some lasting gain that you don't have to worry about something every day, every week. Take, for example, my work, actually where I used to work, when new people would come in and try to purchase a product, some training or some working with a coach, they would the manager would invite them to encourage them strongly to purchase an annual membership or, you know, the whole year rather than like 1 month's worth. So there was an effort in this business to make people commit, because it would benefit them, it would benefit the gym, because it's a long-term plan. And take, for example, insurance companies, car insurance, life insurance, and lifelong warranties. Now, people like to purchase products that last a lifetime, and that there's a warranty, because if it breaks, they realize it can break at any time, so you know, if it breaks, I have this warranty, I can go back to the manufacturer or the store and I can get a brand new one, or they can fix it for me at no cost. So they like, you know, lifetime warranties. And people in general are more likely to purchase that product because it's got that warranty with them. So this is the nature of people. And business have preference to make long-term gains. So we can use this example to present a spiritual, the attempt of other people to try for spiritual happiness. And I can always back it up with some reference from Bhagavad Gita. There's a nice verse, chapter 2, verse 40. Verse 40, I read the Sanskrit. Nehabri krama nastosti pratyavyayo navidyate svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat. So in this endeavor of bhakti yoga, or spiritual path of bhakti yoga, there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear, which Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport is the fear of death. So for the materialist, is the end of all activities. We can use the example that we can actually quote this, or we don't have to, but for some people who are ready to hear from the scriptures, you can quote this verse of Bhagavad Gita. For those who are not, maybe this example will suffice about even in material affairs, people look for long-term commitments in business, relationships, at least that last a lifetime. So why not invest in a happiness that's spiritual, that goes beyond the material realm, beyond the physical body, and doesn't cost anything, just our time and some effort, maybe do some chanting, do some reading. You know, it doesn't cost anything, so it's like a lifetime warranty, or, you know, many forever warranty that you can use this example. I found it somewhat useful. I use it sometimes when this situation calls for it. So this is the temporary nature of material happiness, and maybe we can discourage and gently steer those materialists to strive for spiritual happiness. The second quality of material happiness is it merely relieves the symptoms of our disease, which is like what I mentioned, is our envy of Krishna and staying in ignorance of Krishna. It is a very sensitive issue for the materialist. If you point this out to them, that they are envious of God or they're forgetful of God, they may have some unpleasant reaction. They may not want to talk to us, so we have to be careful how you say it, that you know, you're sick and you're just trying to relieve the symptoms of your disease, but doing all these things, smoking cigarettes and doing this and that. Somehow we like to convince them that by using different arguments or, you know, different examples, maybe some of you may use it, or, you know, someone who hears this talk, maybe they can use it. It sometimes works for me because I work in the fitness field, and it may be useful sometimes. Many people realize, even materialists, they realize that there is a difference between Western medicine and the Eastern medicine. There is this Chinese medicine, there's Ayurveda, that's part of the Vedas, and homeopathy is also considered holistic medicine, maybe not Eastern, but homeopathy, maybe you have heard. And then there's Western or allopathic medicine, that the characteristics of Western medicine, most people know that you will talk to them and they can understand this example. Western medicine focuses on curing the symptoms and managing the symptoms of your problem. And you take some pills that are synthetic, pharmaceutical drugs, or you do a surgery, and you cover the symptoms, you take care of the symptoms, but the root cause of your illness stays the same. And it's a matter of time before it resurfaces in a different place of your body or mind. So Western medicine is not concerned about your whole body and how the disease came about. It's concerned about managing the symptoms so you can continue doing what you're doing, what you've been doing, and just keep coming back to the clinic and keep getting those pills and pharmaceutical drugs. And no matter that the pills will cause some side effects, they will cause some other illnesses, and then you'll be getting more and more pills. And in my experience, I've seen 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds people and 40-year-olds who are on like take a dozen of pills already. So this is Western medicine. The Eastern medicine is relies on alleviating the symptoms by understanding the cause of the disease, and the treatment is very mild, usually, and gentle. No surgery usually, unless your condition is very acute, and they prescribe some herbs and go to the root cause of your illness and see what kind of lifestyle or what kind of activities caused you to become ill in the first place. So if you take these herbs and manage your symptoms, you change your life a little bit, so you won't have to take any pills and you will not have to have any surgery. You just understand the cause of your disease, and then you regain your full health without reliance on artificial pills. So this is like in a nutshell, the difference between Western medicine and Eastern medicine. I use this example sometimes to make those individuals who are not devotees understand about the temporary nature of these activities that they perform to alleviate the symptoms of their unhappiness and boredom. They're bored and not happy, so they do smoke and do this and go party and do that. So, but they can understand this example. Since usually they come to our gym, they are already kind of, their mindset is that I want to get better. Maybe it's only working out, you know, maybe just do some cardiovascular activity, but there's always a chance to mention to them about changing their lifestyle and do more healthier ways to eat, healthier ways to think and meditate, maybe do some yoga, convince them to change their lifestyle rather than rely on doctors, Western doctors, and on their pills, synthetic medication, pharmaceutical drugs. This way they will regain their true health and also awaken themselves, put themselves in a better position to cultivate some spiritual activities. And the third characteristic of the material happiness is that it is enjoyed in ignorance of Krishna. So it's not true enjoyment, just like we have mentioned, just covering the symptoms of the disease. It's oriented at satisfying our own senses. There is this verse in chapter 7, verse 27, that no one is an exception to this, maybe except for some spiritually empowered incarnations of God. No one is an exception to this ignorance. Chapter 7 of Bhagavad Gita, verse 27, Icha dvesha samudhena dvadva mohena bharata sarva bhutani sammoham sarge yanti parantapa. O scion of Bharat, O conqueror of the foe, that all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities that arise from desire and hate. So unless those unfortunate individuals run into contact with, run into devotees of Krishna, they have no chance of awakening, or have very little chance. Krishna shows most of his mercy through his devotees. It is even said that devotees are more merciful than Krishna. So it's very special. Srila Prabhupada is just our perfect example and inspiration. I also would like to mention verse 27 of chapter 9, that you can quote to those who you come in contact with in relation to trying to relieve the symptoms of their disease, trying to be more holistic and maybe adopt some of the Eastern medicine ways to practice their to add to their lifestyle. So you can quote this verse from Bhagavad Gita as well. Whatever you do, yat karoshi yad asnasi yad juhasi dasi yat yatapasyasi kauntya mat kurushva madarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, whatever austerities you perform, do that, the son of Kunti, as an offering to me. So once those individuals understand that they want to relate to the true cause of their suffering, and they don't want to just manage the symptoms, they want to go to the root cause of their disease, they can offer some of those healthier activities to God. They can offer them to God and gain some benefit from that. That would be considered karma yoga already at that level. If they do some activities, you know, in the mode of even passion, they can benefit if they do it for God. There was a nice story, I think. At one point, I was very surprised to read this years ago. Srila Prabhupada was giving a lecture, and you probably know more details about this, but I'll just relate it. I really like it. He was giving a lecture, and someone walked in the middle of the lecture, some drunkard, and he had a beer and vodka in his hand, and he asked during the course of the lecture, or maybe it was another point. Anyway, he asked Srila Prabhupada, Swamiji, can I become God conscious by drinking alcohol? And he was holding this vodka beer in his hand. Srila Prabhupada answered that, yes, you give credit to God. You understand that God gave you this. He gave you free choice and ability to drink. And he created everything. Then you become God conscious by drinking alcohol like that. So this is a kind of an extreme example of trying to not discourage and beat up those people who are really not at that standard level of behavior that we are practicing. They're not ready to give up me, they're not ready to give up certain things, but you can certainly speak to their reason and the things they can relate to, and maybe that will have a better effect, so they will not be averse to us, or they will want to associate with us because we don't judge them, or we don't say something that may hurt them, because they have different sensitivities. We may not have those sensitivities, but those materialistic people are very sensitive in different ways, and they may have a bad impression of us sometimes, just because of untimely or maybe overexcited. You know, you're too excited, and sometimes you want to preach too much, and they get hurt, sensitive, and they have a bad experience. So anything they can offer to the Supreme at one level, it can help them get closer to God and they get inspired to change their life more and more, step by step. In conclusion, I'd like to say that it is very good that devotees fully understand the science. The spiritual science of happiness can clearly contrast it with material happiness. And they're able to share this effectively with others, non-devotee audiences, to create a more lasting effect and more lasting interest in a spiritual path of bhakti yoga, and thus make Srila Prabhupada pleased by our efforts in different ways. Thank you for your attention, and I hope I get some feedback for you from you about this. Čekat palubjasca kripa sindubjasa veća patitam pavanebe vaishnavebe namo namaha. Any questions or anything?
Thank you, Arjuna Charya Prabhuji.
You're welcome, Prabhu.
This point that you mentioned about being sensitive of people's capacity of taking the philosophy or the different approach or the different paradigm of life, and sometimes if you expose them, you know, like the example that you gave in the beginning of that project that you were working with the person. So obviously they were not ready to come to the temple, and or the person was not ready, and then the reaction was negative in one sense. So the fine line of being sensitive while approaching people that are outside our circle of practice and lifestyle, being able to share with them according to how much they can take. So that part, to have that part, be careful about that part. But also on the other hand, to sometimes we ourselves try to hide who we are.
Right.
You know, which in one sense also is not a very healthy approach of to deal with people.
Right.
So there's a balance between those two things of being sensitive and respective to people's position and beliefs and capacity.
Right.
And the other thing is to be respectful to our beliefs and our and who we are.
Right.
And we go to sometimes in our devotee circles, and sometimes you see it with people that come from other countries, you know.
Right.
When you come to a different country, which is a different culture, sometimes you are a bit ashamed even to show your traditions or your ways, you know. So you're trying to quote-unquote adjust to the culture in which you are.
Right.
And see that you belong to this, you know. So we go to so much extent to hide things that are part of our daily life and our being, you know. And that in itself also may be an obstacle to reach and to connect to people. What do you think about this?
Wow, Prabhu, that's a very great point. You know, that could be a subject for another talk, like some devotees... And, I have these feelings myself too, sometimes in different situations. How much of my practice should I hide? How much should I wear tilak to work or not? I mean, what's allowed, what's not is one thing, but what we feel we can do for Krishna and others is nothing. It's a very interesting point you made about devotees being maybe shy or afraid of practicing in the open when they're not with the Sankirtan group, when they're like, you know, going to work, and, you know, some people work at banks, some people work at restaurants, some people work, you know, it depends on the place of work, but there may be some limitations, but within those limitations there is some room, there is some leeway, and you can present or preach effectively at that level. I mean, you're certainly right. I mean, that could be a big obstacle. One of our anarthas, like being we're not proud of Krishna consciousness, maybe we're hiding it in the one level, and we're just comfortable with talking to devotees about it, and but we're not really comfortable wearing tilak to work or chanting in front of others. Like, you know, let's say you have a lunch break and you take your bead bag and you start chanting in the break room, and then some people may ask you questions. You come to this point where all people see me, they're like looking at you, and like there will, some of them will ask questions at that time or later. But at the same time, it sets up a stage for future interactions and preaching. They will bring it up again when they see you chanting. They'll ask you, "What is this? Is your hand? You know, you hurt or something? What happens?" You know, they ask me sometimes, "Are you okay?" I says, "Yes." "What happened to your hand?" I say, "Oh no, I'm just meditating here." You know, so you're certainly right. I mean, it's another subject of discussion. How much should we hide? And within those rules that the external society has for us, different workplaces, what can we, you know, it's a fine, you know, really, between you and Krishna. I mean, if you can wear tilak to work, wear it. If the boss said no, hey, can't wear it, maybe do it with water, and maybe at one point you'll have a different job, or you can wear a tilak to work. You know, it's hard to answer, but certainly it's a very good point, Prabhu. Thank you so much. Yes, Prabhu.
Hi, Bo, Prabhu. Wow, you made a lot of wonderful points. I wish I could mention them all, but I'm not very eloquent. I have a bad memory, and
you are, Prabhu.
And some of the notes, I didn't have a pen at first, so but I'll kind of relate it to what Subal and you just discussed, and kind of my original question is something I appreciate about Prabhupada, and maybe you could expand on some of these points. One thing that Prabhupada mentions, I'll just mention it, and something that you saw that Prabhupada did in his life, in chapter 17, verse 15, of the Gita, chapter 17, verse 15, right. That verse talks about austerity of speech. And in that purport, Prabhupada mentions that one should not try to instruct somebody unless that person has accepted you as their teacher, mentor, guide, etc.
Wow.
And we see this in Prabhupada's life. When he first came to America, he didn't start his preaching off, "I'm your guru."
Right.
He just started to chant Hare Krishna. And they saw that his love, his character, etc. Then I think it was Brahmananda Prabhu who first asked Prabhupada, of course not at the time, that wasn't his name, he said, "Aren't there some rules and regulations we should be following?" So Prabhupada never tried to instruct them, but they saw that he had the love, the character. There's a quote that says, "Nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care." And so sometimes things take patience, and Prabhupada was definitely patient. And this kind of goes back to my original point, some of the points you made that I really appreciated, the warranty point. And it basically, you were mentioning this, we have a lifetime warranty. You quoted that verse, eternal warranty, neha bikramanashti, just a little devotional service could protect you lifetime after lifetime.
Right.
And I kind of related that to one of my favorite points, is that we see that products are very attractive if they don't break down.
Yes.
If you have a Mercedes Benz and it broke down in a week, it's not very attractive. And so we see that the qualities of Prabhupada, Prahlad, their character didn't break down in the most difficult situations. We see Hiranyakashipu, his character broke down when Prahlad just disagreed with him.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we see that they developed that faith in Prabhupada's character because you had two heart attacks, you did such and such determination, you're not breaking the work, my boss is getting upset for the most smallest things, my wife, my children, they're exploding, even I'm exploding. And so therefore they develop faith, you're so attractive because you're actually doing this for me and you don't have any ulterior motives. So my question is related to the fact that it's similar, but basically when we hear that we have a lifetime warranty, just like on a Kartik board outside, it mentions that if you offer ghee lamp to the Lord, you'll be protected from the sins of many births. We have so many warranties in our lead, but at the same time, it seems like because we have these warranties, we're not so inclined to increase the quality of our character. Oh, I have a warranty. If my character breaks down, if I criticize devotees, if I become envious, if I make so many offenses, but we see if you make offenses, you're not happy. If you're envious, your demon is miserable. So sometimes it seems like we have these warranties, which kind of are detrimental to actually steadily increasing the quality of our character. So what do you think about that? Or what are some steps we can move forward to not be so concerned about the warranties and more concerned about Yasyasti Bhatir Bhagavati Akinchana Sarvir Guna? Prabhupada will always quote this verse, Sarvir Guna is Tata Samasti, increased all of our qualities. So maybe you, the warranties and qualities. So anyway, I hope the question is clear. So
yeah, I think it's a little bit clear. Well, when I was mentioning the warranty example, it's meant for those who are non-devotees. So to present it to them like that, maybe they'll be more attracted to start some spiritual process or do something. For devotees, we don't have to use these examples. Like you said, it's best to focus on just chanting, and then while chanting, also try to develop good qualities. And they're much easier to develop when you chant, obviously. This example was meant for when you talk to non-devotee audiences, you can use this example. I used it, and, you know, lifetime warranty, you know, in business, and this and that. You like long-lasting gains and long-term plans, so why not, try this, and, maybe it'll make your spirit feel better. Then you won't be so miserable. I probably want to say it in a different way. So that was meant for non-devotees, the lifetime warranty. But we should focus on chanting, and the qualities will come, and it's good to be aware of the qualities as well. Just like when you chant, you should also be aware of being surrendered to Krishna in every situation. You chant, but then you don't forget about Krishna. You try to still think about Krishna and how you're surrendering to Him. And then, so the qualities, you can also be conscious of what you need to work on. It's also good. So I hope that that's somewhat helpful. Thank you, Prabhu. Hare Krishna.
I was just reflecting on your usage of the one particular verse of everything one eats and does, do it as an offering to me. I mean, Krishna's talking. Using that to help persons, I guess, at least make the connection with God. And it seemed to me a pretty dramatic verse to introduce.
Yeah.
And why it seems dramatic is because the culture, there's a big divide in the culture. It's a line one doesn't cross going into persons' religious beliefs.
Right.
I mean, at least in this culture. So I was just wondering if you had found that brings about reaction, because I do think this culture has a very definite boundary line.
Yes.
That, one can speak about everything, but if you go into the personal space of religious belief system, that is like a taboo area. So
right.
I was just wondering when you have actually used that verse to at least allow persons to make a connection with God, whether they have one or not, I don't know. You're having to judge according to the circumstance, but what has been the reaction when you've quoted that verse?
Well, good question. Thank you, Mataji. Well, I try to present the principle. I don't quote the verse most of the time. Just present the principle, and I don't mention that God's name has to be Krishna. I mention Jesus, offered to Jesus, offered to Allah. I wouldn't mention unless they have some interest in Eastern traditions. I wouldn't mention right away that, oh, it's from Bhagavad Gita 9:27. Read this. Oh, I have the book, by the way. Here you go. So I would just present the principle versus just like quoting like Sanskrit or anything like that. Which is one of the few verses I remember in Sanskrit. But, right. So I didn't quote it too often when talking to those who are non-devotees. Thank you. Any other questions? And thank you very much for letting me speak again. Have a great day in Krishna consciousness. Vanchakarpa Pavyascha Kripa Sudha Vajavacha. Vajidam Pavanebhi Vaishnavi Venamu.